This is David Stafford talking. I'm in Sydney, BC. It's the 30th of October, 1982, and I'm about to interview or talk with Norman Rubinstein about his prisoner of war experiences. I'm checking the tape, checking for levels. 1, 2, 3, 4.
I'm Norman Rubinstein, and I'm going to talk about my 5 years as a prisoner of war in Germany. And I'll begin right at the very beginning. I volunteered for the Territorial Army during the Munich crisis. I felt that when Neville Chamberlain came back and said that he had brought back peace with honor, I turned to my brother and said, I think it's time honor became more honorable. My mother and father felt that it was a wonderful thing, and I was a little warmonger, but I was quite convinced that there was going to be a war, and I should at least be prepared. I didn't join as a Jewish person who wanted to fight the anti-Semitic Nazis. I joined because I felt that the British way of life was worth fighting for. We were trained well as searchlight men, but we had absolutely no idea of anything to do with infantry. It was always considered that we'd be well behind the lines. In June of 1939, one quarter of the anti-aircraft units were mobilized, and we were mobilized for 4 weeks. And then stood down. And then on August the 24th, 1939, I was called up again, and it was quite obvious that the war was very close to us. On each of those occasions, I got £5, and with that £10, I managed to pay off all my debts. Life was really quite boring in the anti-aircraft. Nothing very much happened. Our first searchlight station was on the roof of Middlesex House, which is on Vauxhall Bridge Road in London. And even today, I believe there is some wire netting around a certain portion of the roof that was put up especially so that I would not fall off the roof in the dark. It was there in 1972 when I last saw it. I haven't looked again, but I have been told by members of my family in England that it's still there. In January 1940, just after we had been changed over to artillery, the Royal Artillery from the Royal Engineers, there was a call for volunteers for overseas service. And we decided we would go as a unit of 10 men. And we said we would all volunteer as one unit, providing we all went. Well, you don't tell the army what you want. They decided that I and the sergeant in charge were the only two who were going to be chosen. Sergeant White left first in the middle of January, and a couple of weeks later I was given 2 days leave and then sent to Kinmore Park in Rhyl in North Wales. When I arrived there, they had no idea why I was sent there, so they said, you better spend the night here and then go on to Hereford. They had a fire drill that night. I was unfortunate that way. When I got to Hereford, they had no idea why I was sent there. I could have carried on my journey and deserted, but eventually they'd have found me. But the idea was at Hereford, well, as you're here, you might as well stay. And I became a member of the 2nd Searchlight Battery, 1st Searchlight Regiment, Royal Artillery. We went overseas on March the 17th, 1940. We went to France. It happened to be my mother and father's silver wedding anniversary, so I cast a blight on that. And we went from Dover to Boulogne. And from Boulogne, we went into the Pas-de-Calais and took over some searchlight sites from a unit of regular searchlight men who were being relieved. And we settled down to life in France. We were in a little village called Guines, spelled G-U-I-N-E-S, not far from Calais, and life was very pleasant. By the beginning of April, I was given one stripe and became a lance bombardier, and I was made deputy commander of a searchlight unit of 10 men. Within another 2 weeks, I was given a searchlight unit of my own to take over, a detachment. I always remember our officer, Lieutenant Pierce, taking me along and saying, "Now remember, Rubenstein, show them you've got teeth. If they've got nothing to do, make them do it again." So on parade that night, when I lined them all up, I opened my mouth and I said, "Lieutenant Pierce wants me to show you that I've got teeth." Well, here they are. We didn't have very much to do for a while, and then our battery headquarters happened to be at Armentières, the place where the lady came from. It was really the town of Chapelle d'Armentières, and it was my misfortune when we, as a troop, were standing down for a week, it was my misfortune to be guard commander on the day of May the 10th when Germany invaded France. Instead of a guard of merely 4 men, I suddenly found I had 20 men. I had absolutely no idea what orders to issue, but fortunately for me, there was a regular soldier amongst these guards, and he said, "Look, I'll whisper quickly to you and quietly the orders you're to give, and then you shout them out." And I did it as though to the manner born, as though I'd done it for years. I enjoyed sounding the air raid siren when we got that through, and then suddenly orders were issued for us to move over to Arras to take over the air defense of the headquarters of the British Expeditionary Force, where Gort was, Viscount Gort. And we moved on to Arras, and we were stationed, my searchlight unit, just outside the town, and we noticed a hut not far away, and being very much warned about fifth columnists, we thought, well, there might be somebody there. And I said to my second in command, "Cover me with your rifle." I don't think he knew how to use his rifle. None of us had been shown that. "And I'll go over and see whether there's anyone in there." Just as I was walking across the field on my own, a German fighter came down practically to ground level. It was a Stuka, strafed the field, was obviously after me, and I just plunged down. I can still see the bullets coming along in front of me, and then to make sure that he'd got me, he turned round and came back again. Fortunately, he missed, which is fairly obvious. When I got to the hut and blew off the padlock with my rifle, it did look as though somebody had been burning papers there. But nothing else happened. And then volunteers were asked for to fight for Arras, and we realized that the Germans had broken through. This would be about the 16th of May. Within 6 days, they had already gone so far. And orders were issued that no detachment commander or second-in-command can go. Well, two of my men went, and I never heard of them again. I assumed they were killed. To give you a further idea of how badly trained we were trained on Lewis guns in London. When we got to France, we found there was nothing but Bren guns, so none of us could use them, and one of the sergeants had to go and take a course on Bren guns and then teach us how to use those. Also, in my own searchlight unit, I found that the first time a German plane passed over, which was before May the 10th, one of my spotters, who used binoculars, was blind in one eye, and one of my sound locator men was deaf in one ear. So, with the wisdom of Solomon, I changed them over, and I was given a great commendation by battery headquarters for showing such considerable sense. How these two even got into the British Army, I don't know. But we were then given instructions after the men had volunteered to defend Arras to take the guns, the anti-aircraft guns, out of Arras. And we spent a couple of days on the road and came back close to the area of Calais. We left the anti-aircraft guns, 3.7s there were, at the town of Ardes, where I had one of the few conversations that I was able to have with the lieutenant who was in charge of B Troop. I was in A Troop. His name was Airy Neave. And both Airy Neave and I said, well, we don't think things look too good, do they? This is about the 18th of May. We were then moved to the town of Calais, and my searchlight unit was on what is called the Sangat Road, slightly west of Calais itself, and on the main railway line from Calais to Paris. I set up my headquarters in a first-class compartment and thought how nice we'll be by the sea for the summer. We went paddling once or twice, didn't go swimming. Every night the German aircraft came over and bombed the town of Calais. We couldn't understand why they wanted to bomb a town so far from the front line. And much to our amusement, one of our battery members, we heard, was sent back in disgrace to England, one of the few who ever got back, because he had caught a social disease in the brothel, the black cat. Shows that the wages of sin do pay, because he was one of the few to get back to England. And we lost our Lieutenant Pierce. He was called back to England. We weren't sorry to see him go. We didn't like him very much. Got a very new, raw young man. Pierce was put in charge of a searchlight training unit in Gibraltar, and I think saw the rest of the war there. On the morning of the 22nd of May, after our new lieutenant had come round and told us the sad news that the black cat had been destroyed the night beforehand in an air raid, we heard a tremendous amount of what we thought was bombing coming from the south in Boulogne. Had we realized it, we would have understood that the Germans had cut right through to the sea and were now doubling back in order to meet with those who were coming down through Belgium and close the noose round Dunkirk. They started shelling Calais that night, and none of us had any infantry training at all. Most of us were searchlight men, pioneer corps men, cooks, or medical corps, and there was really no intention to take us off. I had had two chances to get back to England. Our lieutenant colonel came round my searchlight site in April, asked me what did I do before the war, and I said I was studying law to be a barrister, and he said, well, you can always be sent back in order to take your exams in June. And I said, oh, I don't want to miss the fun, sir, in any case I haven't studied since June of last year, so I'll wait until things settle down. And the first night of the attack on France, our major called me and another bombardier into his office and said, I want to send you two back for a commission. There's very few boats going to go back to England. Are you ready to go? And again, we said, oh, well, we'll wait until it settles down into trench warfare and we don't want to miss the fun. Well, all three of us, including the major, were captured. That night of the 22nd, when the Germans opened fire, first of all, on Calais, I was able to see the searchlights in the sky from the south coast of England, and say to myself, there, if you hadn't been a fool, you might still be. We didn't realize it was any more than what we were told was a large detachment of Germans who had broken through and were trying to get back to their own lines. The next day, the Queen Victoria Rifles and other elements of the Rifle Brigade were sent over. The Queen Victoria Rifles in particular had been trained on motorcycle units, and they were not with them when they came. They had no motorcycles. They came as pure infantry. We saw them go up through our lines towards Boulogne. We saw very little of them come back. During the morning, when I was defending still the main railway line from Calais to Paris, an infantry officer came out and gave me my only piece of infantry training. There were 10 of us, 6 rifles, 1 Bren gun. And he turned to me and he said, "You know what to do, Bombardier, don't you? Dig yourself in, and when you see the German tanks, open fire. I'm off now." And that was my infantry training. I turned to my second in command, Lance Bombardier Pierce, who had been married on his embarkation leave just a few weeks beforehand, wore glasses, and I said to him, "Okay, Pierce, you take 4 men with 3 rifles and defend this side of the embankment, and I'll take the Bren gun and the other 4 men and 3 rifles, and if one of them gets wounded or killed, then just hand over his rifle." Within a few seconds, I turned and looked at Pierce, and I saw his fingers twitch, and I realized he'd got a bullet right between the eyes. Maybe it was because it was a sunny day and a sniper had got him because of his glasses, which had caught the sun, but I often wonder whether it was my fault I had put him in that position. But that's war, and you can't really blame yourself. The Germans did a very, very good military campaign against Calais. They completely surrounded the town. They could have marched in on the night of the 22nd or the day of the 23rd, and most certainly they wouldn't have needed to take until the 26th before the town was completely captured. We got moved on the 24th of May from my position on the main railway line back to the station, near the station at Calais. We were told we were going to be evacuated, but 4 times Churchill did say that the eyes of the Empire are on Calais. The longer you hold out, the longer we can do things, the better we can do things in Dunkirk. Well, the eyes of the Empire were on us, and twice Brigadier Nicholson, who was in charge of the rifle brigade that came over, turned down an offer by the Germans to surrender. He said death sooner than dishonor. He died in captivity, as a matter of fact. And on the afternoon of the 25th, the Germans opened fire with every piece of artillery that they had. We've been told since that there were something like 18,000 of them against 4,000 of us. It was one of Guderian's panzer divisions that was against us and elements of 2 others. And we had 30 minutes of the most intense shelling that I think anyone could have, one of the worst hours of my life. Fortunately, as at Dunkirk, most of the shells fell in the sand, and had they fallen on buildings, they would have caused much more damage. But as they fell in the sand, it was just a question of spraying the sand. And that night, we slept a little. There was a rumor, a scare, that the Germans were using gas. Then it was found that they weren't using gas. And on the morning of the 26th, very early in the morning, I found myself with 2 other members of my battery in the station transport officer's office. And we had what was going to be my last good meal. We had a bottle of champagne, a can of raspberry jam, and army hardtack biscuits. A sergeant came in and said, "Don't you know this is the station transport officer's office?" And I looked at him and I said, "Aren't you aware that he left a long time ago? Sit down and have some champagne," which he did do. And then we were told it was a question of every man for himself. "Make your way to Dunkirk. There's 1 tank between you and Dunkirk." Well, as I always say, it was a very big tank. It surrounded the whole of Calais. And walking along the beach, 6 of us from my battery found our major's chauffeur lying on the ground. He had been left there by the medical corps in the hope that he'd be taken off by sea, very severely wounded. We put 3 rifles under him to make stretchers, and carried our other 3 rifles, and we were carrying him along the beach, as we thought, towards Dunkirk, when a British officer came up to us and said, "Look, it's useless you going on. The Germans have landed one of their fighters up on one of their Messerschmitts on a high sand dune, and they're machine gunning the whole of the beach. You'll never get through. Destroy your rifles and you must be prepared to be captured. This was a terrible feeling for me. Being Jewish, I had no desire to be captured by the Germans, but there was very little I could do about it. So we destroyed our rifles, and at that moment another British officer came along, one of these comic opera types, and pulled out his revolver and turned to this officer and said, "Who told these men to destroy their rifles?" And the first officer said, "I did." And he said, and the second one said, "Shall I shoot you now or shall I shoot you later?" And the first officer said, "Oh, well, shoot me when you bloody well like." And the other one just wandered away. A few minutes later, the Germans did come through. They treated our wounded friend well. We were surrounded immediately by them, disarmed, made to stand with our hands up. I had to think it was a little like an American Western film. They took our field dressings away. But being men who had experienced the fighting, they understood a little about how we felt. And we were sitting down, waiting to be moved, when one of our own people, some distance away, opened fire, shot one of our own men in the chest, and I believe he died later. We did hear also that the major's chauffeur died the next day. A very sad case. His mother had been widowed in World War I, and now she lost her only son in World War II. We were finally marched away after I had learnt my first lesson as a prisoner of war, that you look after yourself first. The Germans had permitted us to hand in our water bottles to two of our comrades who would be allowed to fill them and then hand them back to us. I never got mine back. We started marching that evening, and we spent the night in the cemetery at a little town called Marquise, because there was railings round it. I don't know whose grave I slept on, but it wasn't a very good sleep. And then we began to march through northern France. Straight away, I found that the Germans spotted my features and would immediately shout out, "Ah, there's a Jew there." And I knew that life was not going to be very pleasant for me. So I decided that as little as possible would I make myself seen to them. I would, as we say now, keep a low profile. I did give myself at least 3 years as a prisoner because I knew Britain was in such a bad state. And I knew that I would have to survive somehow. On about the fifth day of the march, we were in a town called Dèvres in the soccer stadium, and it was there that our officers were separated from us. And there a little tragedy happened for me. We were given a soup of white beans, etc., and the only bowl I could find was a French Army steel helmet. And I was not aware that these steel helmets had air holes. And much to the Germans' amusement, as they poured the soup into my steel helmet, all the soup ran out, and I was left with 5 white beans. That was my food for the day. At the beginning of June, after we'd been marching for 5 or 6 days, some members of my battery, 3 of them, came up to me and said, "Ruby," I was naturally known as Ruby to most of them, "we want to escape. And we've heard of one fellow who escaped and got looked after very well by the French. And as you speak French, will you come with us?" Now, this presented me with a problem. It was my duty to help them. It was my fear that stopped me. But I finally decided that I had to go with them. Case of having leadership thrust upon you. So I said, "All right, I'll come with you." We managed to dash off the march into some hedges and got into a farm where a French soldier was busy milking a cow prior to joining the march again, and I just said to him in French, "Don't say a word," and he didn't. We lay under the hedges all day and moved by night. And very nearly got caught by a convoy on the third night, managed to stop just before the convoy stopped. They were so close to us that when they were relieving themselves, they very nearly urinated on us. I was lying next to a corpse that was extremely dead, to say the least of it. We had been in one house a couple of days later and saw some people there, thought that they would be friendly when we moved in, and tried to speak to them. We found they were all dead. They must have been killed by the percussion of shells falling around the place, and we just dashed out. And then on the morning of June the 10th, much to our dismay, we had been given clothing, by the way, civilian clothing by the French, much to our dismay, we couldn't find a barn in a building where we could hide during the day, so we had to hide up in a barn which was more or less on an open field. And one of the other fellows and I decided we'd forage for food. We were walking past an empty, the windows of an empty house on the inside, when two men in uniforms not quite like the, not quite the same as the German army, walked past, shouted to us, "Halt," and in bad French, when we got out, said, "What are you?" And I said, "Oh, we're refugees." I spoke better French than they did. And "Where are your papers?" I said, "We've lost them, we never had them, we're looking for food." And then unfortunately they turned to the other chap who couldn't speak a word of French, and I had to say we were English soldiers. And they said to me, I recognized the flash on their shoulders indicated they were SS, they said to me, "Are there any others of you?" And we had already heard of the massacre of Hasbrook, as it's called, where the German SS had got hold of some of the Warwickshire regiment, shot Lieutenant Allen in front of them, herded them into a barn and set fire to the barn, and when they came out, machine gunned them as they were running out. So I knew that unless I revealed where the other two were, all that would happen is that the SS would probably hold us for shooting and then go into every barn and set fire to until the other two came out. So I said yes. They spotted at once, of course, that I was Jewish, and we had to bury a French soldier. He had been dead a long time and was, well, more or less leaking. His flesh was so decomposed. I had to do all the digging and the pickaxe work, and I fainted twice. And I said to them, "Well, I think we should make a cross for him." And with a broken rifle, which the Germans did give us, we made a cross. We found out from his clothing that his name was Paul Dubois. There was a letter there in his pocket. We put that up, but of course the first rainstorm would probably have washed it out. And then the Germans, two of the SS men who had been the worst to me, one a perfect blue-eyed, fair-haired, rosy-cheeked Aryan, and a very dark-looking man, came up to me, pulled me by the hair, shoved me aside, and said, "Now, your comrades will go to a prisoner of war camp, but tomorrow morning we shoot you. Under international law, you're a soldier and you're in civilian clothes, therefore you're a spy. But the main reason is that we're the SS and you're a Jew, and the SS kill all Jews." So I went over to my friends and I said to them, "This is my family's address. If you ever get back to England, you must tell them what happened." And they said, "Well, so what can we do to help you?" I said, "Don't interfere. They'll only do the same to you." And then I sat down. I wasn't being particularly brave. I'd reached that stage where I was so completely fed up, I didn't give a damn. I thought it was a shame at the age of 21, having survived the Battle of Calais, to go this way. I looked around, wondered which wall they'd put me against. Would they blindfold me? And I thought, no, I'd refuse a blindfold because I understood German and I'd know when they were shouting fire. And then I sat and I took out my pipe. I used to smoke a pipe in those days, and lit it and smoked. And these two who had been so rotten to me looked at me and looked at me, and after half an hour I heard one say to the other in German, "Jude oder kein Jude, das ist ein Mann. Jew or no Jew, that's a man." And from that moment onwards they were as nice as anything to us. They came up to me, slapped me on the back and said, "Providing you work as hard as your comrades, you'll be treated as a soldier." They went to the next farm, killed two chickens which they stole from the farmer, cooked them for us, gave us bread and everything like that, and for the rest of the time we were with them, we had a wonderful time. Whilst we were eating and throwing our chicken bones into the river, we'd got to the Somme, I suddenly found in my pocket a plan which I had found in a house the day beforehand of all the German artillery positions in the area and what time the guns were to fire, written by a man called Hauptmann von und zu Wehr. And I realized that if they search me and find this on me, they'll certainly say I'm a spy. So I said to my friends, "Look, carry on throwing the bones and get some stones into the river," and I wrapped this plan round a rock and threw it into the river, and they never found it. And we were marched off the next day. Another three British who'd escaped were put on the end of the column, and the German commandant in charge of this column kept on rushing up to the end of the column. Are the seven Englishmen there? Sind sie sieben Engländer dort hier? He must have done that about 10 times that day. We were even much past the place where we'd escaped, got to the town of Peron, where they cleared out chicken houses for the seven English of us, and we spent the night sleeping rather well on straw and chicken manure. I found myself a pair of French army trousers. I found amongst the rubbish that was there a sewing kit. I needed the French army trousers because during the time that we were digging the grave for Paul Dubois, my trousers had split. They were a little tight on me, the civilian pair. And that began my career as an international soldier. From then onwards, we were marched to the town of Cambrai, where we went to the fortress.
Do you think that's a good place?
I said that life on a searchlight unit was boring. It certainly was. We would get up after doing our 4 hours on guard duty at night. We would get up probably about 8 o'clock in the morning. One chap was cook, and I had the job of cleaning the Lewis gun, which I had to do every day. I don't know, sometimes there seemed to be enough parts left over for two Lewis guns, but eventually I got everything straightened out. And then, really, there was very little to do. The only excitement we had was one October day, round about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a German reconnaissance plane passed over the area of London. It was never particularly mentioned in the paper or on the news. At that time, my father was on air raid precaution duty in Hampstead, and this plane passed over. We were told that they were waiting for it, and it was shot down over the Humber. And they didn't even publish it so that the Germans wouldn't know. But Sergeant Marney, who was one of the company sergeants in charge of a searchlight unit, he apparently shone his searchlight on it during broad daylight. And it was always said after that that Sergeant Marney should have a black beam for daylight work. I had had an incident with Sergeant Marney long beforehand when I was just a member of the territorial unit. And I was arriving with my family outside the Strand Palace Hotel. We'd been to the theatre. We came in a taxi. Marnie opened the door, and I searched in my pocket and found a threepenny bit and put it in his hand and said, "Take this, my good man."